Although it was conceived as a piano piece, Claude Debussy's Arabesque No. 1 sounds so well suited to the harp that it seems to have been written for it. And although it looks cumbersome in some ways, in the right hands, the harp is the epitome of grace. I'm Norman Gilliland.
And I'm Emily Auerbach. This is University of the Year.
The harp is capable of other effects, too, and we'll get to those during this hour. But what does it take to make a harp sound good? How well does its soft voice fare in the context of an ensemble or an orchestra? What emotional range does it have? And what composers knew best how to write for it? Our guest is Yolanda Condonassis, one of the best-known harpists of our time, with 14 CDs to her credit and more on the way, most of them on the Telarc label. She's also the head of the harp department at the Cleveland Institute of Music and the Oberlin College Conservatory.
And welcome to University of the Year.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's such a beautiful sound. Now, you started as a pianist, right?
Right.
What led you to the harp?
Well, you know, it was a funny thing. I was very committed to the piano. My mother was my piano teacher from earliest memory. So I was playing the piano as soon as I could crawl up on the bench. But when I was about, I believe I was about eight at that point, our family took a weekend trip up to Chicago. And I think it was Valentine's Day weekend. And we happened to walk by Lyon and Healy Music Store, which at that point sold everything. They sold, you know, pianos and all instruments. But perhaps for Valentine's Day, they had an elaborate window display of, I don't know, maybe 15, 20 harps in the window. And both my mom and I were so transfixed by that idea of, I grew up in Oklahoma and there aren't a lot of harps floating around, or at least weren't then. Maybe now there are. But it was a pretty rarefied thing in my part of the country at that point. And so it kind of planted a little bug in my mind. And after not too long, we ordered a small harp, which was a very big deal. And I remember it was it must have been about a year later that it arrived, because it was snowing in Oklahoma when they delivered it. And that does not happen but in the deepest, darkest part of winter in Oklahoma, at least. And so, it kind of took off from there. And it was very easy for me to play the harp at first because I had had so much piano training. And I think we tend to either like very much or become bored with things that are easy. And fortunately, I liked it very much and went to the next step and was really, really hooked by the time I realized how difficult it actually is to play the harp.
Well, it can look difficult. And when you say that because you played so much piano, the harp was easy, it's hard for me to figure out why, because isn't the action, so different
it
from
is
plucking
very
a
different
string versus tapping a key.
Yes, it is very different, but there is a lot just in terms of conceptualizing the strings and the parallels to the keyboard. And just musically, I think it made sense very quickly. But of course, the harp I started on had no pedals. And that's where it really gets to the point where you really need to have several levels of consciousness, several levels of coordination.
Fingering harder if you don't have the pedals.
Well, not so much. The fingers and the feet are coordinated, certainly, but the technique is very different, large muscles versus small muscles. It's very much sort of a patting head, rubbing stomach sort of endeavor. And, and also what you start playing as a beginning harpist is going to seem very easy compared to a Beethoven sonata, which is what I was working on the piano at that point. So it was a good hook because I thought, wow, this is a breeze. I'll do it some more. And I really loved it so much by the time I realized, whoa, this is a little more involved than I thought, that it was too late to turn back then.
You sort of fell in love with the harp, it almost sounds like, visually, seeing it in a window.
Initially, yes.
But if you take a piano piece and you do the same piece on harp, what is it that makes you like it in some ways better, or the sound?
Well, I love so much about the harp. I love the tactile feeling of actually playing the instrument. And that is one of the things that really pushed me towards choosing the harp over the piano, because there's just something about it. The way it lays on my hand, the way it feels to play, it's just fun. It's just tactily enjoyable. And, of course, again, I had a little bit of an advantage because I had so much digital discipline up till that point. You know, if you're starting cold, having never really learned finger independence and having, finger strength individually, I think beginning to play the harp is much, much more difficult. But I fell in love with the feel of it. I fell in love with the sound of it. And so many of those things translate so well to the piano repertoire. And, you know, being a pianist, and I continued the piano for many years after starting the harp, that so much of this is music that I love and have always loved. And I suppose I felt there was no reason not to play it on the harp as well, especially given that my first training on these pieces was on the piano. And I think there are plenty of transcriptions and plenty of interpretations of piano music on the harp that maybe are treated as a new entity entirely. And I suppose what may make my transcriptions, my renditions of these pieces perhaps unique is that I try and make them as fully informed by pianistic precedent as possible, not to just, you know, play the piano on the harp, but just to give them the stylistic components that make them so special on the piano, but just transfer that to a different sonority, a different color, and make them work in the same way, but with an added dimension.
I'd almost think that harpsichord would be even easier than piano when it comes to translating it into harp music, because again, it's a tactile thing.
I would say, though, that the harpsichord sound, I was just actually doing a masterclass right before I came here, and one student was doing a Scarlatti sonata that I've recorded, and I was telling her that to really make that work on the harp, you have to think legato as you would hear on the piano almost, but give it the attitude of the harpsichord. And I mean kind of feisty attitude that you get on the harpsichord, because otherwise it's going to sound very plucky, very unresonant, and the harmonic continuity is going to be missing if you go for that very struck sound that you get on the harpsichord, which I don't think is necessarily all that constructive to imitate on the harp. In fact, one very interesting thing that I like to do is take music not only on keyboard instruments written originally for that, but to take music written for the lute, which was a very popular Baroque instrument. And I transcribed an entire Bach lute suite, which I'm very, very fond of. And I think that is a very smooth translation to the harp because the sonorities are so very complementary.
Thank you.
does sound like lute music that way.
Yeah, you know, with all of that, I play it down closer to the soundboard, which gives it a woodsier, more early music timbre.
I was noticing it has a sort of deep soul-like sound that I don't usually hear on the harp.
Yeah, well, it's the phrasing, too, has a lute sound. I'm not sure what it is, but it's like there's the pauses almost in between phrases and then the ornaments.
Yeah, you know, I really tried to steep in this a lot, of course, listening to a lot of different recordings, but also working with an early music and Baroque specialist who really gave me a sense of the stylistic differences in ornamentation and phrasing and breath points and resolutions on the lute or a stringed instrument versus a keyboard instrument, because the ornamentation you do on a lute is going to be considerably different than what you might do on a harpsichord.
Let's jump with both feet into the romantic world of the piano then and see how, by contrast, you would handle something, you know, say Chopin that has chords in it. That's very different from that, no pun intended, strung out lute.
Right.
Effect.
Well, you know, when you're working with both harpsichord music, early keyboard music, lute music, what you're going for is a drier approach. You want to cut a little bit of the resonance of the instrument, which going down lower, playing lower on the string accomplishes. But for the romantic literature, you want to be right in the middle of the most resonant, beefy part of the string. And you play it with a very different touch. You use a different finger action. You get away from the string in a much different way. And your goal is legato with that, as opposed to, you know, a drier, more articulate approach. And so much of my favorite piano music, the Chopin, the Mendelssohn, Respighi, Satie, all of that requires just the ultimate in legato. And it's almost, I mean, some people consider it a contradiction in terms, because on the harp, we have no sustaining pedal. The where we get our sustain sound is just in the resonance of the string. And so you have to become kind of a master manipulator of your own resonance and know exactly a little bit about the physics of the vibration pattern and how to let it ring the longest and get it in the spot on the string where the vibration will be the biggest and the widest and the most ringy. So that is definitely the approach for music such as Chopin.
What a beautiful C minor prelude that was, but it sounds so different to hear a harp just playing solid chords rather than, you know, the arpeggios that we usually hear.
Right. Well, on the harp, quite often if a harpist sees a chord, there's a natural tendency to break it or roll it, arpeggiate it. And given that I studied this piece on the piano long before I ever even thought about playing it on the harp, I couldn't conceive of hearing those chords rolled, because one would never do that on the piano. And so to accomplish that, again, it takes a different touch, a different tactile approach, but it had to be a little bit slower to let the full chord ring through. Mm-hmm. I would play this a slight bit faster on the piano, but that way we get the full resonance. If you go back in on a string while it is still ringing too soon, not only do you get sort of an unattractive buzz sound. I mean, you can do a lot to avoid that, and that's kind of a bugaboo of mine, that I really cannot stand extraneous surface noise on the harp. But you don't want to have that buzz, but also you just don't want to squelch the sound. Even if you can get in a sort of nothing but net, buzzless way, you chop the sound prematurely. So that's why I selected just a slightly slower tempo. But I think it works. And I just, you know, same with Clair de Lune. That harpists typically break a lot of the chords. And
yes,
having studied that at length on the piano, I couldn't do that as much. There are a few chords in that piece that aren't broken. But, you know, and also same with things like Mendelssohn, where melody lines are so important and you can't bury them in so many noodles that you can't, you know, you can't hear them. There has to be kind of a less is more approach when dealing with the harp, because inherently there is so much ring and resonance to manage. You have to help the listener sort through the filigree to find what's important.
I suppose a concert hall must really make that even more complex.
Well, playing in a concert, and I always say this, when concert presenters are taping something for live performance, I'll ask them, do you want me to play to the hall or do you want me to play to the mic? Because it's, you know, I've been doing this long enough, it's a very different endeavor. If you want me to play to the mic, I will play in a very different way. So it's a trade-off, because in a hall, you know, I'm lucky to have had really wonderful training that was very geared towards filling up a hall. And if you want to be a harp soloist, which is what I am, you have got to have a big sound that people can hear.
Yes.
And so it's just a matter of moving the entire dynamic range up. And on a recording, a pianissimo would be inaudible in a hall. So a recording mezzo forte might be a 2,000-seat auditorium piano. So it's a sensibility that over the years you just develop and adjust.
Well, I still kind of, ever since you've said Mendelssohn, I want to hear it. Can you tell us what to listen for?
Well, again, you know, this is a pianistic thievery, but so many of these transcriptions I did for an album called Quietude. And Telarc, we had done, you know, probably at that point, I don't know, 7 or 8 albums of, you know, traditional harp repertoire, themed repertoire. But this was to be a chill out album, something that you could listen to and cool your jets and of a consistently quiet nature. And when looking for that, I mean, so much, to me at least, so much harp music is so inherently interesting, so full of color and contrast and timbral effects. And so I turned to the piano repertoire because I know it so well, and because, you know, you really can find a lot of piano repertoire that is of a consistent mood and nature. And this Mendelssohn meditation I thought was so perfect for the Quietude album that I just had to do it. Thank you.
Meditation from Songs Without Words by Felix Mendelssohn, the harpist, Yolanda Kondonassis, our guest for this hour, and we'll be back with her shortly. This is University of the Air.
Support for Wisconsin Public Radio comes from AIG Travel Guard, insuring travelers worldwide and offering bilingual career opportunities within a rapidly expanding company. Career information online at travelguard.com/careers.
I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach. Our guest is Yolanda Kondonassis. And our topic, inevitably, the harp, which is her instrument, and a very versatile instrument it is. We've already found out how well it can take over lute music or keyboard music. What about various national flavors, though?
Well, the harp is one of those instruments that has a counterpart in just about every culture's arsenal of instruments. We have Asian versions of the harp. We have African versions of the harp. Certainly the Middle East is full of harp-like instruments, Irish instruments. Folk culture in just about every nationality like that concept of the triangular frame with strings on it. And so it's just another great opportunity for color and for variety. And, you know, I spend so much of my time playing the traditional repertoire, the harp concertos, the solo repertoire, recital repertoire, that what's really fun on a lot of my albums is that, you know, we have had always as a goal in creating an album concept with, you know, my label Telarc, we've always had the goal of creating a coherent but contrast-filled representation of an idea or a theme or a concept. And pretty much one running theme through just about every one of my projects is a variety of nationalities.
I heard that in one of your albums you decided to have some of the proceeds go toward the rainforest.
Right, that's correct. It was a really natural evolution to that idea because I have long been very concerned about the issue anyway. And one of the pieces that I very much wanted to record was one called The Spirit of Trees. It had never been recorded and, you know, little played, even live. And it was written by the American composer Alan Hovhaness. His background is Armenian, and his music takes on so many national flavors. You get a touch of Middle Eastern sound in his music. You get lots of Asian influence. And we decided to do an entire album of his music because he's a very popular composer, and he wrote a great deal for the harp.
A lot of variety.
A lot of variety, a lot of different styles, and all original for the instrument. And when we were conceptualizing this album, it seemed like such a natural idea with this composer whose music is very spiritual in nature and pulled from so many different cultures. And, you know, certainly deforestation is a problem on varying levels in every country in the world. And, you know, industrialization and lack of regard for the planet. And so it seemed even more appropriate that this composer who drew from so many cultures would write this music of such a spiritual nature and be just a perfect project to funnel some funds to an organization called the Rainforest Alliance. It's a great organization based in New York, and they do so many good things to promote awareness and to, you know, actually assist in at least slowing down this dreadful process of deforestation. So it was an interesting album to do, and I'm just so happy in some little tiny small way that it also helps promote a good cause.
And so what would be a good example of the Hovhaness flavor?
The mixture of cultures. Well, you know, some of the music on this album sounds downright American, but probably something that might be neat to listen to would be the first movement of his Spirit of Trees for harp and guitar.
Thank you. I don't know why. It makes me see camels, but often does. I think it's that Armenian cast to so much of what he does, rainforest notwithstanding.
Very exotic.
But it's so relaxing somehow. So much of the music you've played so far.
That's so far.
Okay. Now, you talk about different kinds of international flavors. What about if you turn to Spanish music, which is certainly, you would think, less relaxing and a little bit more...
Right, a little more kicky. Yeah, there's a lot of that. And in fact, that is going to be a pervasive theme of a recording project I'm doing very soon for Telarc as well. But we've spattered a bit of that along the way. And of course, the Spanish harp is certainly an entity, and you know, they're smaller harps, but you still get a lot of that flair and flavor of the Spanish instrument. We did Malagueña on my Romantic Harp album because it's just so, you know, passionate and full of great sweeps of sound. So that, I think, would be a good example of that.
That's
sound.
Ernesto Lecuona, so Spanish dance, but Cuban composer.
Right. Thank you.
That was Malagueña by Ernesto Lecuona, the harpist, our guest, Yolanda Condenasis. And, well, you pulled that one off. We've got the Armenian sound from Hovhannes and now a very convincing, fiery, all but castanets Spanish sound from Lecuona.
Complete with a lot of glissandos. Are those as hard as they sound?
Oh, no.
No, they're just, no. Just for
well,
show.
Well, you know, I must say, to do a good, even controlled glissando is harder than just running your finger up the string. But that's, that's not the hardest thing we do for sure, unless you count the blisters.
You mentioned that you also tried to represent Asian sound on the harp. What are some examples of that?
Well, the Asian culture has always placed an importance on the harp as an instrument and many, many variations thereof. And there's a wonderful piece that I did for years as a transcription for the harp and flute by Michio Miyagi called Haru no Umi. And originally written for the koto and the shakuhachi flute, it worked gorgeously for the just flute and the regular harp. And being the glutton for punishment that I am, I suggested to Telarc that we do a version of this piece in two tracks with me playing along with myself. We've done a few of those projects through the years.
Just straight overdubs, you mean?
Straight overdubs, but not as easy as it might seem, especially with a classical acoustic recording setup. You're sitting there with the one-eared headphone, and the thing you don't, or at least I didn't plan on, was just the ever so slight delay. So I would have to do at least four or five takes where I would learn, you know, because it would sound exactly together to me, but really acoustically and what was going on tape, there was a delay. And so I'd go in there just completely confounded, thinking, you know, that was exactly together, but yet it sounded like a blurry overlay. So it was difficult to do, but I think kind of an interesting representation of this piece because it's essentially for two harps, but I just happen to be playing both parts on this recording. And I think it really lends it an interesting color and sonic burst of resonance at times. But again, you know, I play with the parts of the string and lots of ways to alter the color and dry up the sound and make it sound a little bit more twangy, like a koto might sound.
Haru no Umi by Michio Miyagi.
Well, you both did a good job there.
Thank you, both myself.
That must be hard to know that you can't do that, though, in concert unless you played a one track and played over it.
Yeah, you know, this is one of those pieces that's probably more a recording novelty than a concert piece for me. It was atmospheric and worked on that album that was all devoted to images of water. And the Haru no Umi translates something close to ocean in springtime. So it worked for the album and, you know, probably not so much a recital piece, luckily.
On the other, a very different kind of flavor would come from any kind of influence from jazz or blues.
Right.
Do you have any example of that for the harp?
Yeah, you know, that, again, we're back to stealing music from the piano repertoire, but I loved the three Gershwin preludes that he wrote for the piano. And this is the middle one, which I think is the bluesiest, most jazz-inspired of the three, perhaps. And I recorded that on my very first album, Scintillation. This is Gershwin's Prelude number 2.
Prelude number 2 from Three Preludes by George Gershwin, as interpreted by Yolanda Condonassis. And we'll find out some of the latest developments in harp techniques and effects when we return in a moment. This is University of the Air.
WPR offers many ways for your voice to be heard. Audience services can assist you by phone, mail, or email. Your questions, comments, and suggestions are welcome anytime. For more information, go to WPR.org and click on Listener Feedback.
I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Yolanda Condonassis, an internationally known harpist. Can you tell us about your newest album, Salzedo's Harp? Who's Salzedo, and tell us about his music?
Well, Salzedo was a tremendously influential harpist and composer and teacher, and he was a prolific contributor to the harp repertoire. And this album is comprised entirely of his music. And what I had aimed to do with this was give a really concise sampling of his three different compositional styles. Traditional, which is very accessible, very crowd-pleasing showpiece kind of music. And then his transitional style, which was his beginning forays into new timbral effects, new colors, new technical effects on the harp even, using the harp in different ways, knocking on the soundboard, sliding up on the strings, whistles, you know, all kinds of neat effects. And then his pretty much full-out contemporary style. And hopefully in the course of this album, one can get a really good sense of who he was as a composer. And you can't really separate him as a composer from his ideology and his philosophy of the instrument and what he thought it should be. And I was trained in the legacy of his pedagogy as well. My teacher, Alice Shalafu, was one of his most prominent students. And so I feel very steeped in his ideology as well. So this was a very special thing for me to be able to do. And just all of his music, it's like an artist using the full canvas. It's like taking it to the edges, what it can do and do well. Him being a harpist, he knew, and so he really used it to the fullest. I think one of his most beautifully representative pieces in a very short amount of compositional time was his Chanson dans la nuit, or Song in the Night. Thank you.
So was that a fade-out or was that you going?
That was me, the manual fade-out.
A manual fade-out with the smoking fingernails.
That's right.
So there's knocking and all kinds of nails right. and everything.
Yeah, I've never heard a gliss quite like that, though. That's very effective.
Well, you know, what was great about Salcedo is he knew what could be done and he knew what really worked and what just sounded like a gimmick. And so he stayed away from that and did things that, you know, really, really produced a new sonic atmosphere.
Are there sort of stereotypes about the harp or about harpists that you're hoping to shatter with pieces like that and other ones that you're working on for new recordings coming up?
Oh, absolutely. That's always been a mission of mine, to bring people along in their view of the instrument. And the greatest compliment I get after concerts is, gosh, I never thought the harp sounded like that. That's totally different than what I imagined. And, you know, while I don't want to knock people over the heads with new ideas, I think the best kind of concert when it comes to the harp is one that gives folks some of what they like, expect, envision. And then once they're in a nice, satisfied place, then you push them a little further and they're much more willing to listen to the harp being aggressive and assertive and coloristic and new in its approach. So, you know, that's a mission for me. And part of that, I think my next frontier in the next 15, 20 years of my career will be commissioning new works. And I have a new one that will be premiered next season, a kind of a big orchestral consortium premiere and recording season with the composer Bright Sheng. And we were talking about Asian music a little bit ago. I love the way he mixes new and contemporary ideas with that of the ancient and the old and the folk. And I think it really pays homage to almost the history of the instrument in a way, certainly in one part of the world at least, and also brings it forward in a new and extremely assertive way. This is a man who writes music that is not shy. And that was certainly a big convincing factor to me in selecting him. So that'll be premiered with the San Diego Symphony and the Dallas Symphony next season and be recorded by Telarc the following January. So in a little over a year, that will be out. And, you know, it just, I think whenever you have a career, especially on, I suppose you could call the harp a slightly underserved instrument, you have to appoint yourself an ambassador for not only your own offerings, but the instrument itself and, you know, seek to educate and expand the vision that people have of what you do. And then, you know, hopefully in the same swoop, convince them that they like listening to you do it. So it's always been that for me.
Well, it's been nice to have you be the emissary for your instrument for the past hour.
Well, thank you for letting me be that.
And on our airwaves many times over in the last, must be about 13, 14 years at least, that those CDs have been coming our way. Our guest has been Yolanda Condonassis.
Thank you so much for having me.
I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you'll join us for the next hour of University of the Air. Why was Chicago given to Illinois instead of to Wisconsin as originally intended, and why should we be happy about that? And how did Wisconsin end up with two governors at once? Next week, during University of the Air, Odd Wisconsin. Join us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.